Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week, meditation instructor Marcus Casey continues our examination of the book Cultivating True Compassion by Trungpa Rinpoche. Today's talk covers the beginning of Chapter 3, The Training in Bodhicitta, Part 1, Disciplines. Once we aspire to transform ourselves through love and compassion, we need to discipline the mind to resist the selfish habits that have kept us captive for so long in the world of suffering the Buddha called samsara. Through moral discipline and training in samadhi, or meditative absorption, we build a framework that will take us all the way to enlightenment. If you enjoy our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
My name is Marcus Casey, and I'm one of our volunteer in meditation instructors at Columbus KTC. When Lama Kathy's out of town, or Lama Tom is teaching at another center, we have a group of our meditation instructors who fill in and give the Dharma talks. And we usually work our way through a book by one of our lineage masters. So today, this week, right now, the last month or so, and for the next month or so, we are working our way through a book called Cultivating True Compassion, Bodhicitta and the Bodhisattva Vow. I apologize, I don't have a hard copy of it. I've been using an electronic copy of it, but hard copies are available. It is a book by Trungpa Rinpoche, who is one of His Holiness Karmapa's teachers. And this week we will be going through Chapter 3, or at least starting Chapter 3, The Training in Bodhicitta. So one of the key aspects of Buddhism is training our minds. According to the teachings of the Buddha, we realize our innate positive qualities by following what we've come to know as the Eightfold Path. And I won't go through the whole Eightfold Path, but the Buddha summarized his entire set of teachings in four slogans: abandon what is harmful, practice what is helpful, tame your mind. These are the teachings of the Buddha. Now that fourth one, these are the teachings of the Buddha, is basically saying that the teachings of the Buddha are not other than this. Those first three slogans, abandon what's harmful, practice what's helpful, and tame your mind, cover the entire teaching, and there would never be anything outside of that. Those first two, abandon what's harmful and practice what's helpful, they seem kind of obvious, but they're a lot easier said than done, right? And that's where that third one comes in, tame your mind. Because when our minds are not in our control, the first two become a lot more difficult. And when we have a tamed mind, then we are better able to abandon what's harmful and practice what is helpful. And that is a lot of the reason we start with learning tranquility meditation, because meditation gives us that practice over our minds and that control over our minds. We use meditation to gain mental tranquility and stability and to increase our bodhicitta, and I'll define that in a little while. So today we are talking about disciplines for increasing our bodhicitta. Now, we traditionally say the four-line refuge prayer at the beginning of all of our talks. The prayer is in Tibetan, so some of you may know it and can join in, but if you don't, you can feel free to listen and make the aspiration that you will awaken and help others to awaken. When we are chanting this, we are repeating our commitment to take refuge in the three jewels, the Buddha, or what we aspire to, the Dharma, or the path, and the Sangha, or the guides and companions along the path. We will chant the refuge prayer three times. Sangje Chudang Tso Gi Chog Nam La Jiang Chu Bardu Dai Ni Kyab Su Chi Dagi Jin So Ki Pe Su Nam Gi Dro La Pen Chir Sangje Dru Par Sho Sangje Chidang Soki Cho Nam La Jiang Chu Bardu Dai Ni Kyab Su Chi Dagi Jin Soki Pe Su Nam Gi Dro La Pen Chir Sangje Dru Par Sho Sangje Chudang So Ki Cho Nam La Jiang Chu Bardu Dai Ni Kyab Su Chi Dagi Jin So Ki Pe Su Nam Yi Dro La Pen Chir Sangje Chu Par Sho. Okay, so I want to start with a quote by His Holiness the 17th Jawang Karmapa. He said, "It is not the case that just because we adopt the Mahayana Dharma, we suddenly become courageous bodhisattvas. We have to put ourselves through a process of rigorous training and study." So let's define terms a little bit here. Bodhicitta is the compassionate wish to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. And a bodhisattva is someone who has aroused bodhicitta. And in the context of what we're talking about today, it's someone who has taken the bodhisattva vow. Lama Kathy uses the phrase bodhisattvas in training. So some of us in this room have taken the bodhisattva vow, others may be interested in taking the bodhisattva vow. But what you are vowing when you take the bodhisattva vow is from now and throughout all the rest of your life and lifetimes to consistently strive to become enlightened for the benefit of all sentient beings. Now, part of the training includes sealing our commitment with the bodhisattva vow. And a lot of people will ask the question, why is a vow necessary? And Trangru Rinpoche addresses this in this chapter. He says that a vow is necessary and helpful because it is natural for us to constantly change our minds. Basically, we shift our position back and forth as thoughts arise. And we're, you know, some of us are, for lack of a better term, we're flaky, right? So at some point in our lives, we have listened to the teachings. We've come to a point where we are passionately committed to the idea that we can work toward enlightenment, and that is the best way we can be of benefit to all beings. And then sometimes life comes along and our commitments start to waver. And so it's important to seal that that commitment with a vow, because sometimes we just don't feel like it. And sometimes then it's helpful to fall back on the fact that we've made this commitment and that we've made this vow. I don't know, sometimes bodhicitta comes really hard. Have you ever been through one of those times? Am I the only one? I don't know, maybe you're going through a time of intense anger. Something at work, something political, something like that has you just really, really wound up. And generating that feeling can be really difficult. Now, that's also why we practice daily. That's why we renew this commitment daily, to keep revisiting it. But also sealing that with a vow increases the importance of it in our lives. So I think it's important to also understand, and I've heard this from some teachers, that when you make a vow, you are increasing the benefit. Because you've made a solemn promise, then every time you follow through with that commitment, there's greater benefit than if you hadn't made a vow. They also say the opposite is true. But fortunately, we can constantly renew our vow, and we do try to make it a practice to daily renew our vow and to admit our shortcomings. But that's where the vow comes in. So developing our bodhicitta, as the Karmapa said, doesn't happen all at once, and it is constant and gradual. It's a constant and gradual improvement in our behavior and our practice. So many teachers in our tradition have given us teachings and kind of a path, a gradual path, for how a bodhisattva should train. Many of us are familiar with what is probably the most common, the six perfect virtues. And we've had many talks on those, but those six perfect virtues are generosity, ethics or discipline, patience, diligence, meditative concentration, and wisdom. And then Shantideva, Lama Tam's teaching on Shantideva's text, the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, he presents it very similarly, but just a little bit different according to Trungpa Rinpoche. He says mindfulness, alertness, carefulness, diligence, meditation, and discernment. Now, this book by Trungpa Rinpoche is actually a commentary he's giving on a text by an Indian teacher named Atisha called The Lamp for the Path to Enlightenment. And the essence is the same in this gradual path as well as the first two I've just mentioned, but he's organized it a little bit different way. So this one's organized into just three trainings, and we'll be talking about those. The first is the training in moral discipline. The second is training in samadhi or meditative absorption or tranquility meditation. And the third is training in discernment or wisdom. So those are the three that we're going to talk about today. Training in moral discipline. I don't know if anyone else is like me, but most of us were raised in this country with a very puritanical background, and moral discipline often has a very narrow meaning and has been interpreted very legalistically. So there can be kind of a knee-jerk reaction to that term. But it seems like these days, especially when we have kind of a front row seat to many of our leaders casting aside even the facade of morality, that we start to realize how important a basis for morality is. We start to realize how it's fundamental to our basic goodness. And the problem is not necessarily with morality, of course. The problem is more with how it was interpreted for us, at least myself. I may be speaking only for myself at this point. But morality, basically in Buddhism, is the word for it is tsultram. And when you break it down into its two parts, it basically says manner and properly or appropriately. And basically it refers to keeping our commitments according to what's appropriate for us. So there are many vows of moral discipline in Buddhism. Monks and nuns take very stringent vows. Actually, there are differences even between monks and among monks and nuns. Monks and nuns start out as novices and they take one set, and then as they progress, when they take full vows, they take more. And then for us as lay people, there are other vows, and we'll talk about some of those. So the Buddha recognized that people vary quite a bit, and the moral commitments that we can keep varies as well. So not everyone is forced to undertake an identical code of behavior, and it's not supposed to become a burden on the practitioner. Now keep in mind, it will always, our behavior is always to fall under those things we talked about at the beginning, right? Abandon what is harmful and practice what is helpful. And so those are the ultimate guides for moral discipline. Now, the five lay vows, or vows that are appropriate to us who are not monks or nuns, there are actually four root vows and one branch vow. And they are given here from time to time. They are not killing, not stealing, not lying, especially to a teacher, and avoiding sexual misconduct. And the fifth vow is a branch vow, and that is a vow to abstain from intoxicants. And it is meant to protect the other four because it allows us to remain mindful and not to lose our mindfulness when we are intoxicated, and thus break the other four vows. But all of these are optional. Some people take all five, some people take four or three or two or one. These are commitments you can make. And again, I've heard it taught that when you take these vows, then it increases the benefit you receive from having kept the vows. You might be going along not killing all the time, and then when you take a vow not to kill, then it adds more of an intentionality to it. You've sealed it as a commitment for your life. There are also vows that people take as short-term commitments, especially for specific practices. I know like Nyunye practices have vows that you take for the two or three days that you do the practice. Certain retreats at our home monastery in Woodstock, New York, have commitments that they ask you to take for the duration of the retreat, whether that's a weekend retreat or a 10-day retreat. And so there are short-term commitments that you might make that are much more rigorous than what you would want to commit to for your entire life, but are just for the duration of a specific practice. And in the context of the bodhisattva discipline, moral discipline has three aspects: abandoning wrongdoing, accumulating virtue, and benefiting sentient beings. And the first two are very individual and are a lot like what we talked about earlier: abandon what is harmful and practice what is helpful. And the third is benefiting others, and that's the primary concern of the bodhisattva discipline. So I think it's one more step, right? We're not just abandoning what is harmful. We're actively devoting ourselves to practicing what is beneficial for beings. So the first discipline he talked about is training in moral discipline. The second one is training in samadhi. Samadhi is meditative absorption or tranquility meditation. It's the type of meditation that we teach at 10 o'clock upstairs every week. We often call it shine or shamatha. And no matter how long we've been coming, I would urge you to pop back into the 10 o'clock class once in a while. You might pick up a nuance that you haven't thought about in a long time, and it might help your practice. I know it helped my practice when I started teaching it. Same type thing. You just pick up on things that you may have been meditating for 20 years, but you know, there might be something that you've missed or forgotten along the way. So the question is, how does the practice of just basic breathing meditation, how does that relate to developing bodhicitta? Now, the reason we do it is to tame or control our minds. And when our minds are out of control, it's much harder to abstain from harming others and discipline ourselves to benefiting others. So when our minds are peaceful, stable, and relaxed, we are much more able to be of benefit to others. We're much less reactive. We're much less likely to fall into many of the stories we tell ourselves that just aren't beneficial. Those stories that go around and around and around in our minds. We're able to capture just a tiny bit of separation between our thoughts and our feelings and those reactions. And this little tiny bit of separation between that and the awareness and the mindfulness that watches those and says, oh yeah, in my practice, I've been practicing daily. I sit down and I see these thoughts come up and I see that if I don't entertain them, they can just dissipate and go right away. And you learn that you can do that with all of your thoughts off the cushion as well. You can do that when you have troubling emotions and when you watch the news or whatever it may be that is arousing in you I would say feelings or thoughts that aren't beneficial is the best way to sum that up. Trungpa Rinpoche says that we're constantly bombarded with our thoughts, and he says that for most of us, most of those thoughts are unhelpful or negative. He says we do have positive thoughts that benefit ourselves or someone else, but they are far fewer than the negative thoughts. Most of us really get caught in a web of anxiety or narrow-mindedness or obsession, and I would say a very contracting of the mind. Right? And pacifying our thoughts brings us great benefit because it stops that negativity, it stops that contraction, and allows us to open up. Bringing the mind to rest means we attain a state of freedom or control over the arising of thoughts in our minds. Rinpoche tells us that accomplishing a state of tranquility does not happen just through the brute force of effort alone, but by combining our effort with establishing the appropriate causes and conditions for tranquility, such as faith and devotion. So, faith and devotion in a Buddhist context are really about growing in confidence in our teachers. We practice what our teachers teach us. We start at the beginning and we practice tranquility meditation. And we see that our minds start to react and change in the ways that our teachers tell them they will. And we gain in confidence. So we start trusting our teachers more and more and more. And so it's not so much of an idea of unexamined belief at all. And it's quite the opposite. It's proving to ourselves that our teachers are trustworthy, just like you might do if someone if someone recommends a doctor to you, and you go to the doctor, and that doctor makes a correct diagnosis, you follow his prescription, and you get better, the next time you get sick, you're going to have confidence in that doctor. And that's the metaphor that's used for devotion, and for faith in our tradition. And what Rinpoche is saying here is that if we just try to go it alone and just do the meditation, there's going to be some benefit, but it's not going to be as beneficial as if we pair that with faith in the Dharma and devotion to our teachers and following what they tell us to do. So devotion is basically opening ourselves up to the extraordinary blessings that come from enlightened beings. And the idea is that enlightenment changes a person. And enlightenment, there is a shift that comes with enlightenment that gives these beings the ability to, I would say, share the benefits that they've attained. And they're constantly broadcasting. And our devotion then puts us on that same frequency and opens us up to that. That's the idea of devotion in Buddhism. So, first we talked about training in moral discipline. We take vows. We commit ourselves to abandon wrongdoing, accumulate virtue, and work for the benefit of others. Then we help that along by practicing in meditation so that we can better hold to that. And the third is we train in discernment or prajna or wisdom. Discernment is needed to pair with the other virtues. Faith without discernment can become mistaken. That's what we were talking about earlier. This isn't believing in something blindly. We use our discernment along with our faith, and so we use it wisely. Devotion combined with discernment. Diligence, love, compassion, they're best if paired with discernment. I think we've all heard the term, and I'm not sure where it came from. I think it may have been Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, who talked about idiot compassion, right? If we're not pairing our compassion with wisdom, then we often can have good intentions and actually end up ultimately doing the opposite of what we're intending to do. And the more we grow in wisdom, the more able we are to benefit beings, because we're more able to discern what the right thing to do is. So how do we generate discernment? We can't get it just by wishing for it. We approach it methodically by cultivating wisdom in three stages, which are called the three types of discernment. And these three types are hearing, contemplating, and meditating. So we're going to talk about all of those, and then we're going to practice a little bit of it. So first we'll do the hearing part. You're doing it right now. You've been doing it the whole time we've been sitting here, right? The hearing part is all about exposing ourselves to the teachings. It includes both listening and reading, however it is that we're consuming the teachings. That's the hearing part. By exposing ourselves to the sutras, the commentaries, the teachings of genuine masters, other texts of advice and instruction, we are opening ourselves to the vast store of accumulated wisdom that we have available to us. And I would add that we have available to us like no other time in history, especially for those of us in the West, where it really wasn't available until a few decades ago. Trungpa Rinpoche says that when we hear or study teachings, sometimes it makes sense and we can apply it right now, and sometimes it doesn't seem to make sense at all, and then we should hold off on applying it until it does. So we really work with where we are with respect to the teachings. And Lama Kathy uses the phrase, entertain the notion. Try it on, but if it doesn't work for you right now, you can set it aside and work with what is working for you right now. Maybe at some time in the future it will make sense to you. And so that's one thing that I very much appreciate about Buddhism is there's nothing that's really forced on you to believe. There's really the most, I would say the only thing that it really helps to believe starting on day one is to believe in your own potential to wake up, to believe that your nature is the same nature as that, as the Buddha, and as those who have already awakened, and that you also can do it too. So if there's any one fundamental principle that it's beneficial to believe, it would be that. And everything else comes from there, according to when you're ready for it. So that's listening. The second aspect of discernment is the discernment that arises from thinking or reflection. When we hear teachings, we need a way to determine their validity. We can't just take it on faith based on who said it. We can just take it on faith based on who said it. But the better way is to analyze the teachings so that we can determine why it's valid. When we contemplate the teachings, we prove to ourselves the validity of these statements. And this gives us what is called a special certainty about the validity of the Dharma based on our own reasoning. The full extent of this certainty is a state in which we have determined in our own minds, beyond any doubt, the validity of the Dharma. But there's another step, because it goes deeper than that too. And the third aspect of discernment is the discernment that arises through meditation. Through contemplation, we can really obtain a definitive resolution about the Dharma, but it's only through meditation that it becomes experiential knowledge. And that experiential knowledge is what we are going for. I was thinking about experiential knowledge, and I was thinking about, you know, something falls off a table and you reach for it automatically because you have experiential knowledge with what happens when something falls off the table, right? It's going to fall. It's going to hit the ground. It may break. You react and you reach for it. You don't have to stop and reason with yourself that gravity exists first, right? You skip that step altogether. You know that thing's headed for the floor immediately. And that, I would say, everyone in this room would have a certainty based on your own reasoning that gravity exists. Similarly, we can develop that certainty that the Dharma is true, but that doesn't mean we have the experiential knowledge where it becomes so fundamental to our being that that's the lens through which we see the world. Traditionally, there are two ways that we can come about experiential knowledge. The analytical meditation of a pandita or a pundit, and the resting or placement meditation of a kusalu. Now, a pundit is a scholar who can debate the philosophical arguments of Buddhism, and a kusalu is a simple meditator or yogi who validates the Buddha's teaching through meditation. So, the analytical meditation of a pundit. Monks in monasteries go through a rigorous training to be scholars, and they have debates, and I don't know if you've ever seen a video of Tibetan monks debating, but it's a very active thing. They slap their hands and, you know, they go back and forth and back and forth, and they're going through all these arguments back and forth that have been developed over centuries regarding the nature of reality and the nature of phenomena. Here's a book. This is just a translation of a text by the Ninth Karmapa. It's quite large, 700-something pages long. And this is a summary of a much larger text. This is the concise version of a much larger text by the Eighth Karmapa, by his predecessor. So the arguments are very in-depth and very difficult. And in addition to that, they actually pair that with meditation as well. So they arrive at a definitive certainty through these arguments and through logical analysis. And then they meditate to rest in the state of that certainty so that they can bring that certainty into an experiential way. And Trangu Rinpoche says the advantage is that it's very stable because you're working through it very logically, step by step, but that it's also a very slow way to experience direct understanding in meditation. So most practitioners of the Vajrayana in Tibet, he says, especially if they're practicing under the personal guidance of a realized master, have traditionally practiced the placement meditation of a kusalu. Kusalu is a word that I think means grass or a certain type of grass. It was actually named after the kind of grass that they usually sat on. And I've heard it said that you can actually translate this word as kind of a someone who loafs around and does not a lot, right? And that's kind of the emphasis that they're going for here. Not that you're not doing anything, but that your meditation is based on resting meditation or placement meditation. So Trangu Rinpoche says that scholarly studies are usually used in the context of the first two that we've been talking about, hearing and contemplating. And the context for meditating is usually the resting meditation of a kusalu. So the term kusalu, Trangu Rinpoche says, means someone whose lifestyle is that of the utmost simplicity. So the placement meditation of a kusalu in meditation does not involve much analysis. Most of the instructions in the meditation of a kusalu come to us from the tradition of Mahamudra, or the Great Seal, or Dzogchen in the Nyingma tradition, or the Great Perfection. It's beyond the scope of this talk or the time we have to really open that up and start unpacking what that kind of meditation is today. But the best way to understand it just enough to begin to practice it is to do what we're going to do in a little while, where you contemplate and go through some analysis, and then you let even the analysis go. We teach this a lot in the context of the practice when you're going through the Lojong slogans, the mind training slogans. And there's a section in there at the beginning where you start by contemplating several of the slogans. And then you let go even of that analysis. And you just let your mind rest. So we'll do that in a little while. The Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard wrote, "Purity of heart is to will one thing." And for a bodhisattva in training, we learn to develop a laser focus to desire one thing. And that one thing is the compassionate wish to attain enlightenment for the benefit of other beings. Of all beings. Trangu Rinpoche's commentary on this text has given us three trainings to increase our bodhicitta: training in moral discipline, in meditative absorption, and in discernment. We've talked about listening, contemplating, and meditating. So let's do some of that. Like I said, we've done the listening part. So let's move on to contemplating. If you want to get into a posture that's comfortable for meditation, and take a few breaths and relax. And I'm just going to give you a series of questions. These questions are not as much geared toward looking at the validity of the teaching that we've talked about, but looking at our own experience and our own minds and our own practice and how that's how we're doing in relationship to these teachings. So first, how is my daily motivation? Am I motivated by the compassionate wish to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings? How is my moral discipline? Am I avoiding harming others? Am I benefiting others? How is my tranquility meditation? Is my meditation stabilizing my mind? Is it making it easier to abstain from hurtful actions and practice helpful actions? Am I gaining control over my negative thoughts and patterns? Am I working to develop wisdom and discernment? Do I have certainty in the Dharma? Do I have experiential knowledge of the Dharma? Now let go of these contemplations and just let your mind rest for a few moments. Okay, thank you. So I hope by asking these questions, which were kind of meant to look at ourselves in context of the teachings about the training in bodhicitta and kind of take a little status check where we are and what we need to work on and things like that. I hope that's been helpful. We have time for questions, so we have a microphone here. If anyone wants to come up to the question microphone, ready, set, go. And I'll try to answer as best I can. Yes, sir.
Good morning, Marcus.
Good morning.
Thus I have heard. Recently I was reading, doing some research on meditation, just and going over some stuff. So my understanding is there's two basic, and you brushed upon this, I believe, and this is kind of more of a nomenclature question or conceptual organization question.
Mm-hmm.
But two basic forms of meditation, which you've got the shamatha or samatha mm-hmm. techniques of meditative contemplation
mm-hmm.
and the vipassana techniques.
Mm-hmm.
Which mindfulness, insight,
mm-hmm.
meditation techniques. And within Atish's classification of, I don't know exactly what it was classification of, but you had moral discipline, meditative contemplation, and wisdom. So looking at those two basic kinds of meditative techniques,
mm-hmm.
The shamatha would fall under the meditative.
The second one, right.
Well, and then the Vipassana techniques would fall under the wisdom.
The third one, right.
Right,
mm-hmm.
Okay. And then I've also heard there's a third branch of techniques, which are basically a hybrid, kind of a combination of both.
And that's more the Mahamudra type
right.
thing, right? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I think you're exactly right. And he does actually teach the Mahamudra here in the third one, in
right.
the
so he's
wisdom.
He's pointing out the Dharmakaya.
A little bit. He
yeah.
touches very briefly.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. I got the microphone, but I can't think of anything else to say, so I'll sit down.
No, thanks. I do the same thing. I try to figure out where things fit in the context of the teachings I've heard before, and I think that's helpful. Thank you. Anyone else? All right. Well, thank you for coming today. And hope you have a wonderful week. And before we go, let's dedicate the benefit of being here and listening to the teachings and contemplating the teachings and meditating on the teachings for the benefit of all beings, so that our teachers tell us there's great benefit in doing just what we've done this morning, in being here, and that benefit is multiplied many times when we don't try to hold it for ourselves and just for our own edification, but mentally dedicate it to all beings. So let's do that quietly now. By this virtue, may we progress along the path of training in bodhicitta. And as we perfect our bodhicitta, may we guide others along the same path. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.